This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and JC Abbott on this Labor Day weekend. Fellas, how was it for you guys in your parts of the country? Hodge in Winnipeg and JC out in BC.
It was too hot. It's too hot. We're in September. When the months end in burr, I want to be saying burr. Or if not saying burr, I want to not be feeling hot. And it felt like 33 degrees today in Winnipeg. This is nonsense. I want summer has the right to be hot. I'm not mad when it's hot in July and August, but this is my time now. This is hoodie. This is toque weather. I feel ripped off. But the football was good.
I was also way too hot, but I actually wasn't in my neck of the woods. On Saturday, I had a family wedding in Alberta. So I flew into Edmonton for the day and then was in Blue Ridge at the Mogacross Park for an outdoor wedding with no shade anywhere whatsoever in the baking heat. So I'm a little bit sunburnt, a little bit heat stroke, but we're all good because there was drinks after.
You don't really look too burnt, though, for being a pasty white guy out in the sun all day.
I also have the advantage of having been outside for a high school training camp for the last 2 weeks. So it's sort of burns on top of burns on top of burns at this stage.
I can't believe that you guys are complaining about the weather, but then you are two bigger fellas, so I can understand it.
It gets sweaty.
And I was also at a wedding on Saturday. It was a farm wedding out in rural Manitoba, beautiful wedding. And I didn't get sun because I wore my cowboy hat, which I own. I've owned this cowboy hat for almost 20 years. It was only the second time I've ever worn it. And I thought I looked good. Some people thought I looked like a country music star. I personally thought I looked like a conservative politician pandering for votes. But either way, I'll take it. I didn't get a sunburn.
You gotta wear it for the pod.
A little over. I'll wear it next week. Yeah, why not? It'll be the third time I've worn it. I got a decent picture, If not the picture, I'll wear it on the pod next week, at least for a little bit. And hey, the Stampeders have been playing well enough that they deserve that cowboy hat shout out on the Three Down Nation pod. So
as long as you didn't spend too much money on it, like Doug Ford and his hats in Ontario. That's a conversation for a different type of podcast.
I got it in high school, so whatever I paid, it couldn't have been that much money. But it's a nice hat. It's real wool. It was made in the USA. And mind you, it's 20 years old, back when maybe they actually made things in the USA. I don't know.
Next thing for you to do is go try the rodeo, bro. Go get on a bull.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about the bull, but roping things, maybe I'd be good at roping things. Let's do that at Grey Cup. We'll get Dunk to go out there and run routes, and I'll try to rope them.
When it's in Calgary, how about that? It would make way more sense.
I'm holding you to that. Let's go.
The Three Down Nation rodeo.
Jeez. Hey, we've had dumber ideas. Let's be honest. We've had dumber ideas.
That's true.
Let's get it going, boys. Today we're discussing what's next for Canadian quarterback Taylor Elgersma.
A couple of wild finishes in U Sports football.
A Joe Joe's return to the Saskatchewan Roughriders.
CFL fans walking 65 kilometers to raise money for cancer research.
and which city could host the 2027 Grey Cup. But first,
Labor Day weekend had two dramatic finishes, fellas, as the Blue Bombers scored two late touchdowns to scare Saskatchewan, and Canadian receiver Dejon Brissett had an athletic 62-yard head-top catch and then run over two defenders, by the way, to help Toronto win over the Argonauts. What am I even saying? To help the Argonauts win over the Ticats. Goodness me. Which finish was better?
Well, let's go through these a little bit because I'm going to try to kind of have my cake and eat it too here a little bit. The first game, and by the way, these were the two games worth talking about. No disrespect, Calgary, Edmonton, but like that was a lame third. This was like the godfather of Labor Day classics, like brilliant part one, brilliant part two, awful part three. Anyway, in Regina, you got Kyrie Wilson, right? The game looked over. Two touchdown lead for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. Then Kyrie Wilson, this is just in the last 5 minutes of the game, strips Mario Alford. Zach Kolaris gets on his horse, throws a dot to Carrick Wheatfall. There's a very controversial non-call on the face mask, which is clear as day. Cameron Lawson, clearly.
On that touchdown, dude, on the touchdown, the holding call, Patty Neufeld, bear hugging. Well, Caleb Sanders, did you not catch that one?
I admittedly did not, but I don't doubt that it happened.
It was bad.
Cameron Lawson getting a big old mittful of AJ Ouellette's face mask. Then you had, which was not called, by the way, then you had Trevor Harris with a quick punt. There's the ensuing review where Dietrich Nichols is like, was he out of the end zone? Then he ran in. Did he run out? Where was the forward progress? Crazy call. There was the Jackson Ford 57-yard PI on Nick Dembski. A dot from Kolaris to Schoen. Then Tavon Campbell with the pick two, which sounds terrible to say, but is in fact correct. The pick two, not pick six, pick two. And then, of course, an onside kick where, honestly, it looked like Sergio Castillo got that ball back on replay. It was ruled for Saskatchewan. So to me, that was not the better finish, but it was the more memorable. It was the more iconic finish, the more chaotic finish. It's the one that we're more likely to remember. The other one I thought was actually better football, like the Arbuckle to Jake Herslow. Touchdown was brilliant. Jake Herslow, by the way, unbelievable. Last four or five games for him. Winton McManus knocks down on third down, right, forcing the turnover on downs. But then Toronto's forced to punt. Mitchell gets what would have been a game-winning touchdown to Kenny Lawler. And then, of course, Nick Arbuckle hits Dejon Brissett for a play that I know we'll talk about, which led to Liram Hirilahu's game-winning field goal. So both of these iconic finishes, to me, I think the better finish was Hamilton-Toronto, but I think the more iconic finish was the one that happened on the Prairie. So I'm interested to hear what JC has to say because I know I'm kind of sitting on the fence here.
I'm sort of with you on that fence post because that Saskatchewan-Winnipeg game I think is better overall, and the longer portion of that finish is more compelling, more chaotic. There's more elements to it. There's more controversy with it. But if you're asking me which of the two games at the end had me more excited, more flabbergasted, more shocked, I think it has to be Hamilton-Toronto because of that Dejon Brissett play. It's very rare that you get a football play in that type of moment where somebody does something that spectacular and you're screaming at your television set, go down, go out of bounds, do anything but run for the touchdown. And he's off there still running down the sideline trying to make something happen. He was very fortunate that he stepped out of bounds when he did with 1 second left, because I'm not sure that he made it all the way there for the score. It could have very much been akin to the Dominic Rimes play a couple years ago in BC, where he turned up field and they ultimately lost the game because he didn't go down in time for a game-winning field goal. It's not something we see very often. It's counterintuitive for a football player to play situationally like that and not try to go for the end zone, but it worked out for the better. And because of that roller coaster on that single play, I think it's going to stick in my mind a little bit longer.
I think the Brissett and Argos finish was more rare. Like for that kind of play to happen that late in the game, the dying seconds, we don't see too often. The Bombers and the Riders had more swings back and forth that each team kind of had to ride, especially the Riders,
when they were up, I think it was at one point 14 points. And there were some people talking about, well, this game could be over. It's like the CFL, like you never can say that because possessions can change so quickly. And I mean, you can point to a number of different things. And Hodge, there were a couple of people that commented on your post game thoughts column that were like, homework take from Hodge. If the Bombers, you know, don't make mistakes, they'll win the game. It's like, yeah, that's the truth, right? There were mistakes on both sides. You know, if the Riders didn't make some mistakes like Mario Alford fumbling, then it would have been an easier win for them. But there were still mistakes from the Bombers. Like, I just think some of this trash that we see from people sometimes is laughable.
I admittedly must people muted because I didn't see any of those comments.
Good. Just keep it out of your lexicon because it's not needed, man. Let's not waste energy on it. So to me, it was the Brissett play because I think at the time and also just him catching the football. Like, what was Mick Arbuckle doing, even throwing the ball, man?
No idea.
It was just unbelievable. It's kind of one of those plays where, like, time's running down. You got to get rid of the ball. A sack is death, right? Because then the clock's going to run at the start of the next play clock. But for him to take it off the head top of two defensive backs and Stavros Katsantonis, I thought, like, I don't want to hang the guy out, but probably didn't make the smartest play there, kind of being the second jumper, if you will. Probably should have been helping Moxie out and not allowing Brissett to spin out to the other side. But I understand you want to make a play on football when it's in the air. So there's a lot of elements to that play. And then just before, you had Bo Levi Mitchell looking clutch going down the field. But it shows, fellas, on both sides in that game, how critical clock management is. If you're the Ticats, do you think about taking it down even a little bit further if you could have? Or how important, excuse me, was the two-point convert that the Argos stopped? That allowed them to win the game and didn't send this game into overtime after what Brissett was able to do. That was a thrilling finish.
I've never seen a player win and then lose and then win the game again on the same play. Like, that was wild. Like, Dejan Brissett, who, by the way, is finally, I think this is year five for him in the CFL, breaking out. Like, this was a guy who was an absolute game breaker, an absolute stud at the University of Richmond back in the day, like Spiders legend. And I've been waiting for him, former second overall pick. And I'm not saying he's never had any good games, good performances, but to me, he's a guy who can be like that Sam Emilis, Nick Dembski, Tyson Philpott type of receiver as a Canadian. And he just hasn't been at that level thus far in his career. Unbelievable catch sandwiched between Katsantonis and Moxie. And then he breaks out and it's like, okay, the Argonauts have won this game. He's going to step out of bounds here at the 25-yard line. Liram Hirala, who is money from 32 yards out, bada bing, bada boom, double blue, go home, season saved. They're now 4-8. Not a great record, but potentially good enough to actually make some noise in this East Division playoff race, whereas 3-9, mathematically, you're not out, but for all intents and purposes, you may as well row the boat back to Toronto and then just put it in storage right until May when it's time to try again in 2026. Instead, right? And by the way, maybe not so much in the CFL, but like we've seen lots of instances in the NFL where it's a lot easier to run out the clock late in the game, where guys have broken away, you know, on long runs and they've knelt at the 1 yard line, right? Or they've stepped out, you know, like they've done these things to intentionally give themselves up. And obviously Brissett was trying to score that touchdown, compel or high water. And initially it looked very much like he dove, missed the end zone by a yard, and there were zeros on the clock. And I was like, oh my God, like he's just lost them this game. All he had to do was take one step out of bounds and this game's over. And instead he has cost his team this entire game. And then of course, TSN, credit to them, great camera angles. They had the clock right there on the screen. It was plain as day. Okay, he stepped out 3-4 yard line and there was still about half a second on the clock. So he won the game and then he lost the game. And it turns out, no, it came back. He won the game. So credit to Jean Brissett. Next time, I'm thinking Ryan Dinwiddie's going to pull him aside or maybe have a meeting with the receivers this week and just be like, hey, listen, first of all, love the intensity trying to get to that end zone. That's awesome. But also, there's this thing called situational football. Please, for the love of God, get out of bounds when all we need is a field goal to win the game. get out of bounds and don't wait until there's a fraction of a second on the clock. Get out with 5 seconds left. We could stop the ball. We could win the game. We've got a great kicker and we can go home. So wild finish, certainly in Steeltown.
What I wouldn't give to be a fly on the wall in that receiver room today, right? Because you talk about the emotional roller coaster for us as viewers, but for those players as well, because Dejon Brissett thinks he has that touchdown. He's lying on his back on the ground in the end zone in, I'm sure, utter bliss. He's in Nirvana. His head's in the clouds because he thinks he's won that game. And Mekhi Polk comes over and stands over him. And we don't have the audio of this. We don't know what was said. But it seems like he said chewing Brissett out for losing them that football game, right?
I thought and the so same he's thing. He was like slapping his hand, but not in like a jovial way. He looked angry.
Yeah, he's chewing him out. And so Brissett's on his back. He's gone from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. Then he has to pick himself up, go to the sideline. They make the ruling. And now he's getting dabbed up again, knowing that one of the guys who's sitting beside him on the bench just ripped his butt on the ground. Like, that is a fascinating dynamic. I don't know how Dinwiddie's going to deal with that in the locker room. But you don't see situations like that almost ever in professional football.
All done with Labor Day, fellas?
Well, do we want to talk about Edmonton and Calgary?
No. Dejon Brissett,
they don't deserve
on pace for on pace for 1,000 yards. He set a new career high with 642 yards now on the season. I guess that means he's technically like a few yards shy of a 1,000-yard pace, but I think he'll get there on this current trajectory. So kudos to him, new career high, just 12 games into the season. What is there to say about Calgary Edmondson? I thought Joel Gasson made a brilliant point in our group chat. I thought that the Elk should have gone to Trey Ford at the start of the fourth quarter. And that's not me saying that because I think Cody Fajardo should not be the starter, because I think Cody Fajardo stinks or anything. It's just that at a certain point when you're playing a dominant defense and clearly your offensive attack is getting completely and utterly stifled, it makes sense to just shake things up. And though Trey Ford has not had a ton of success in this league as a starter, he has had a ton of success as that change of pace quarterback who can breathe life into a stagnant offense. And I thought that if Edmonton had any chance to win that game going into the fourth, they needed to make a change. They didn't. And lo and behold, the fourth quarter was a snooze fest. 28-7. Kudos to the Stamps for a brilliant performance. I'm not taking anything away from them. But let's be honest. After two absolute bangers, two amazing football games in Regina and in Hamilton, the game in Calgary was a dud. Like, you can't paint it any nicer than that. You can only put so many layers of lipstick on the pig. Good crowd. Not a great crowd, but good crowd. 27,000 and change. Credit to the Elks fans who made the trip. Honestly, the highlight for me was that hilarious clip they played of the Edmonton Sports Talk fan getting off the bus, asking Dustin Nielsen for a hug, and then Dusty saying no. And when the funniest, best part of the broadcast is something that has nothing to do with the game itself, to me that speaks volumes about the entertainment value. So huge win, then big dud for me on Labor Day weekend. And 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
I wasn't saying the finish was great, but Calgary deserves some credit for what they're doing.
They do.
Improving to 6-0 against West Division teams. And guys, this defense is dominant. Like, we've talked about it multiple times, but it bears repeating. And I know there's 12 guys on defense, but that front four is unbelievable. And then you got Bob Slowick doing things like rushing three while having Clarence Hicks as a spy / late rusher when the lanes open up. Like, the creativity there, I don't think has been pointed out, but the reason that it's so hard for teams to throw against Calgary is, yes, because they can rush just 3 and 4 and consistently get pressure, and they're now getting the quarterback to the ground more with regularity, but it's because then he can drop 8 or 9 behind them. Usually it's 8. It's been mostly a 4-man rush during this dominance to start the season, but it's difficult, man. Like, I felt like, you know, there was a little bit of a chance there when Cody Fajardo, you know, he drove a pass into somebody on a deeper stop route. I forget who the receiver was. I want to say it was Benjamin Victor. And I was like, that's how you have to beat the Calgary defense. It's difficult because you need to stay patient, but you have to throw the football on time. And Fajardo, didn't really do that much at all in the football game. I get that there's a lot of pressure and you might be getting knocked off your spot, but that's how you're going to have to beat this defense, is get the football out of your hands in rhythm and be able to move that front just even a little bit to run the football. Like, I thought the Stampeders took Justin Rankin completely out of the football game. And with Stephen Dunbar Jr. out of the lineup, Rankin is far and away, at least this season, their best weapon, all due respect to Curley Gittens Jr. So that defensive front, we've talked a lot about Jalen Hutchings, and he's going to get NFL looks, had his seventh sack of the season. But the other guys up front there, in particular Clarence Hicks, have done a great job. Flo Ormalade got in there with the sack, and I think his statistics might not be as good because he's garnering so much attention, but it allows the other guys to have these one-on-one matchups. Like, that front, unbelievable. Miles Brown as well, doing his thing.
Yeah, and Jalen Hutchings, when they were rushing three in that game, they had double teams on him, and he was cutting through them like butter. And I just want to say,
his sack, he was being double teamed.
Yeah.
And then he gets thrown to the ground, gets back up, and hustles drops back Fajardo. And makes it. Like, his motor just does not stop, I think, along with the other guys on that front.
Yeah, it's unbelievable to watch. And if I was to provide any advice to any team that's about to face Calgary, when you get that situation, forget about having the other guard slagging out looking for work. Triple team him. Like, triple team Jalen Hutchins, because two is not enough. Clearly, he just splits right through it. Get everybody on there. Maybe there'll be a free rusher. I don't care. I would rather have a free rusher than Jalen Hutchins coming up the middle, because two guys isn't enough to block him.
Yeah, what you need to do is roll the quarterback out of the pocket and like down block play side with three people on Jalen Hutchins. And then just leave the non-play side defensive end unblocked and just tell the quarterback, if you stop running, you're going to get killed from behind. So just don't stop. Keep rolling and throw the ball. Like, that's my offensive game plan if I played against the Calgary Stampeders.
I don't know about that, man. Honestly, I think you've got to be able to just match the physicality. That, to me, is what was displayed here. The Elks offensive line, not able to do it. The Riders offensive line hasn't been able to do it. The Bombers offensive line was not either. Like, they're on another level from a physicality standpoint.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you're in the offensive meeting room during the week, and as a coach, you just tell the offensive linemen, all right, you just got to match their physicality. And then you put on the film, and you see Jalen Hutchings picking up offensive linemen and using him to wipe them with his wipe his butt with them, like, just unbelievable dominance. It's like, oh, all I have to do is match this guy's physicality. Oh, easy peasy lemon squeezy, let's get this done. Like, he's unbelievable. And honestly, I'd say I've been watching the CFL on a very consistent basis for 25 years. There was like I think it was 2016 Micah Johnson, might have been 2018 Micah Johnson, was literally unblockable. Other than that, I'm not sure I can think of somebody on the interior who has been as dominant as Jalen Hutchings this year. And I'd be curious to hear from our listeners who can maybe remember back further than I can, who are a little bit older than I am or whatever else. If you can think of somebody who along the interior of the defensive line has been as disruptive as Jalen Hutchings has been through, I think it's 11 games now this year, please let me know, because I think he's on an absolute incredible run right now. Statistically, there might be guys who are a little better, but I don't think that the stats are telling the true story of everything that we're seeing here.
Well, there's still some other great pieces to the defense.
Yeah. Oh, there absolutely are. I mean, that whole unit has been fantastic from top to bottom. And what a job by Bob Slowick coaching it. For the record, I believe the last defensive tackle to win most outstanding defensive player, which I think we can all agree Jalen Hutchings is very much in the running for, if not the front runner for this season, is Joe Fleming in 2003. I think he had 12 or 13 sacks that season, also a Calgary Stampeder. I was just a toddler at that time, 6 years old, so I don't remember Joe Fleming, but if either of you have any recollection of his play yes. from that time period, that is the closest comparable.
Yeah, and Fleming was a game wrecker. He was but a little bit of a different body. Like, I want to say a little longer, a little leaner. The other thing I remember about him is he, I believe, is the reason why the CFL created a rule against taking your helmet off on the play, because he would sack people and then he would celebrate by taking off his helmet and like looking into the crowd. And I believe he went on record once saying, yeah, I do that because I want people to recognize me. Like, I want people to know what I look like, which as a football player, especially a lineman, can be a rarity, right? There's a lot of linemen who, if they're walking down the street, even big CFL fans wouldn't recognize it, because it's like, oh, I don't, you know, I don't necessarily know what your face looks like. So that's Joe Fleming. That's my memory of Joe Fleming. And yeah, he'd probably be about there. Agreed. But Hutchings, unbelievable. And yeah, I'm not taking anything away from the rest of the guys on that Stampeders defense, but to me, he is the straw that stirs the drink, right? If you have a guy who is consistently beating double teams, it lets a lot of your other guys, I don't want to say play defense on easy mode, but it certainly opens up a lot of opportunities for him to be successful. I'll say that.
You were on the right track, Hodge, about Micah Johnson. In 2016, 7 sacks in 17 games. 2017, 9 sacks in 18 games. And then 2018, 14 sacks in 18 games. So I think it's probably safe to say that he's the most dominant interior lineman since Micah Johnson in 2018. 14 sacks. He's only halfway there to Micah Johnson's total. With all due respect, I think we should try to get that correct. But right now, Hutchings second in the CFL with 7 sacks behind Isaac Adeyemi-Berglund, who's had a great season for the Montreal Alouettes. But that Stamps defense, man, it's hard to beat. And I feel like we saw a little bit of an idea of how to beat them when the Riders played quality football for like 10 minutes when they were in Calgary, right? The Riders were able to actually take the lead in that football game, 15-14, and then didn't even score another point in the second half. But the real key there was Trevor Harris getting the football out on time and in rhythm, even with some of the deep shots. And I think they were able to set up some of that deep stuff with what they weren't able to do in the first quarter, some of the looks that they showed. But, you know, outside that little sort of 10-minute window, this defense has been very dominant, save for, you know, a downpour, which seems to be an anomaly at this point against the Ottawa Redblacks. CFL Commissioner Stuart Johnston, if I could speak on the podcast for once, said on the Rider Broadcast Network, the league will accept bids for the 114th Grey Cup in 2027 for about another month. When do you expect a decision for a host city could be made?
Well, when the Winnipeg, or I should say, I guess the Winnipeg Football Club was awarded the 2025 Grey Cup, it was the spring of 2023, which seemed like really far away. It was 2.5 full years. And I remember at that time, Randy Ambrosi, the league's then commissioner, said they were planning on moving forward, announcing 2 years in advance, which was a little bit of a change from the previous timeline, which was about 18 months. They typically announce in the spring for the following year's Grey Cup. So it seemed to be on that 2 year trajectory. Now it seems like Stuart Johnston, as the league's new commissioner, of course, is keeping that timeline consistent. So it would appear as though we might only be maybe 8 to 10 weeks away from learning who is going to host the Grey Cup in 2027. But in advance of writing a column that will be out Tuesday morning, we're recording this Monday evening, I think I know who the Grey Cup host is going to be in 2027. And I'm not reporting this as fact. I'm speculating here, of course, but I mean, we know the Edmonton Elks won a Grey Cup. They reportedly bid for last year's Grey Cup, or bid last year for the 2026 Grey Cup, were obviously unsuccessful. The Calgary Stampeders being awarded that game, we're all going to Cowtown in 2026. I think for obvious reasons, the league would not want back-to-back Alberta Grey Cups. That's not optimal, especially since after next year's Grey Cup, we'll have had 4 straight West Division Grey Cups or 3 straight West Division Grey Cups with Vancouver in 24, Winnipeg in 25, and then Calgary in 2026. Having a 4th straight West Grey Cup, probably not tenable. So if we're going to the East, right, which I think we will, well, Montreal can't bid. They don't have a facility that can host a Grey Cup at this point. The Big O, maybe come 2029, 2030 could do it. It's not going to be ready for 2027. The Hamilton Tiger Cats just hosted twice, right, in 21 and 23. So I don't think that's tenable. And that really only leaves 2 teams, which is, of course, the Toronto Argonauts and the Ottawa Redblacks. I don't think the Argonauts are in a position right now with, first of all, not having a team president, and then also with MLSE focusing so intently on hosting a World Cup and getting all of these renovations executed at BMO Field, I would be surprised if they put in a bid for 2027. I'm not saying they won't. I'm just saying I don't expect they will, which leaves the Ottawa Redblacks. And guess what? Like, looking at the timeline and some of the reporting that Santino Filoso has done for Three Down Nation on this matter, 2027 is like an absolute home run, grand slam for Ottawa. And the reason I say that is because the hockey arena that currently is home to the Ottawa 67s is being built east of the stadium, I believe it is, at TD Place. They're getting a new arena that's going to double as an event center. Construction supposedly will get underway by the end of 2025, supposed to be done by the fall of 2027. So a perfect opportunity to use a brand new venue for some Grey Cup type of events. Then the other thing is, after the 2027 season, they will be demolishing the north side stands at TD Place Stadium. Those stands are over 50 years old, and they will be replaced over 2028 and 2029. So with the south side being new as of the Redblacks coming back into the league, I think this is 2027. It's got to be Ottawa's year, does it not? Like, what are the alternatives? It's too early to go back to Vancouver. It's too early to go back to Winnipeg. It's too early to go back to Regina. And then out east, it's too early to go back to Hamilton. I don't see a Toronto or Montreal bid. Like, to me, Ottawa, Grey Cup in 2027 seems like a slam dunk. I know that Three Down Nation has reached out to the Redblacks team asking if they have bid for 2027, and if not, if they plan on bidding before this deadline hits. But I think all the signs point right now to a 2027 Grey Cup in the nation's capital.
I think you're on the right track there, Hodge, and I think your logic is very sound. The other element that I don't think you touched on is the fact that for 2 years after those stands are demolished and rebuilt, the Redblacks are going to be dealing with reduced capacity at TD Place. And so if you give them a Grey Cup before that, sort of a boost that helps the team through those leaner years when they're not going to be able to fill the stands quite as much, I think that is another element to the equation. But to play devil's advocate a little bit, I don't think you can rule out Edmonton or Toronto. Toronto, for one part, is going to have renovations done at BMO Field because of the World Cup. I think that could help their case for hosting a Grey Cup. And with all the controversy that has surrounded MLSC and the team for their decision not to play home games at an alternative venue during that World Cup and instead go on the road for their home games, getting a Grey Cup right afterwards the following season could be a nice way to sort of pay it back to the fans in a way, or rebuild those bridges by saying, hey, we've got this big event coming up. And then with Edmonton, obviously we know they were interested, right? They bid on the 2026 2026 Grey Cup. We know that for a fact. But Larry Thompson just got the team. We know that we have a precedent for new ownership coming in, like the BC Lions, and getting a Grey Cup fairly early in their tenure, like we had in Vancouver last year. I think that would be something the league would be interested in. It's also another franchise that is struggling a little bit right now. A Grey Cup could be a boost for that community and that market, reinvigorate some love for CFL football in that struggling Elks fan base. And we know that they've been very active in making bids for other things because they're going to be hosting the CFL Combine coming up in 2026 for the second time in the last number of years because they've been aggressive in bidding for those things. So I don't think you can rule out either of those two as options, though Ottawa does seem the most likely.
You guys laid it out well. I think Ottawa seems likely. I was at the last Grey Cup in Ottawa, which I believe was a 2017, fellas?
I think it was 2016, but keep talking and I'll fact check that.
Shania Twain, the bobsled, snow coming down, Devere Posey, the long touchdown. Remember Sean Lemon sprinting down the field there. There was a big defensive score. I think it was by Cassius Vaughn, if memory serves me right.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. Good memory.
And the Argos upset the Stampeders.
2017. Yeah, 2016 was Ottawa winning against Calgary in Toronto. And 2017 was the exact opposite. with Toronto beating the Stampeders in Ottawa. So those two always run together in my mind because they were opposites. And of course, in 2018, the Stamps finally got their Grey Cup win, their second one of the Bolivar Mitchell era. That was in Edmonton. So I'm not saying it can't be Edmonton, it can't be Toronto, but these are the three markets where it's been the longest, except for Montreal, where again, they need a building. Montreal hasn't hosted the Grey Cup since 2008, just because they haven't had a venue, a facility. My only thing is again, like the Red Blacks cannot host a Grey Cup if they don't get 2027 until 2030. Like the new stands, mm-hmm. the construction that's expected to take place at the north side of TD Place is supposed to take two full seasons. So if you don't give them this one, like to me, that is my pitch to Larry Thompson. It's like, look, Larry, I know you want a Grey Cup. We want you to get a Grey Cup. But like, let's go to Ottawa for 27 because a lot of people are going to travel to Calgary for 2026. Let's let them get excited to come back to Alberta in 2028. Back-to-back, I think, is a tough sell. So that would be my pitch anyway. And but we'll have to wait and see. 8, maybe 10 weeks for an official announcement.
2017, fellas, was the first year, and possibly only one, that we did a Three Down Nation throwdown where we had a big get-together at, I think it was Kraft in Ottawa, right beside the stadium. Vanier Cup. It was great, man. Way more well attended than we ever thought that it would be. But it was a really cool event. So, and we'll see if something like that might be possible in the future.
That'd be awesome. Party at my place.
You invite us to
your place, Hodge. You can't host that many people.
I got a decent amount of room. It could be
There's
good.
Probably a party shoulder room in there somewhere.
No, the party room is wherever I am. Put it that way.
Hey,
that is factually true. Hodge is a good time.
Unless he's grumpy, but that's really usually only in the morning when people are yelling.
Or when you're around.
or when he's sick, which always happens at Grey Cup when he's rugging on energy drinks and Advil.
I was healthy last year, 2023, I got extremely sick. 22, I just had a sore tummy on game day, but I powered through. I powered through.
So brave.
You didn't complain. So brave. Either. Credit to you.
No, I didn't. 2023, I think I did, but I also felt like I was dying. So there was that.
You're not soft like some other media members out here.
Gotta play hurt. Gotta play hurt.
You gotta play hurt.
Final NFL cuts were made this past week, including Taylor Elgersma being let go by the Green Bay Packers. Dunk, what is next for the Canadian QB?
You know, I'll get to that in a minute. In this release, fellas, I just can't quite understand it. You know, there were a bunch of people telling me, like, it's a long shot in NFL politics and all the rest. And I'm like, yeah, okay, let's see what the kid does. Right, because every step along the way, he's excelled, be it at Laurier, be it at the Senior Bowl, be it at his pro day, be it what you heard about him, you know, from the Packers going through organized team activities and then training camp and even the preseason games, he looked like he fit into place. And then Matt LaFleur, the head coach for the Packers, was asked, what do you want in a third quarterback? And he said, and I quote, somebody who can command the offense, close quote. So you release not only Taylor Elgersma, but Sean Clifford as well, who had been in that offense for multiple years of the Packers drafted in 2023, to bring in Clayton Tune, who has literally no experience in your offense. Like, I get you might think that he's a better prospect, but he hasn't played one snap in your offense going into the NFL regular season, and somehow the decision is made that he's a better option than Clifford and Elgersma. And I thought, for what it's worth, Elgersma clearly looked better than Sean Clifford, but I guess that's not saying much at this point because the Packers didn't even keep him. So, you know, it's just another chapter to add to the book of, I think it goes down about NFL politics, guys. If this was Taylor Elgersma having transferred from Wilfrid Laurier University to an NCAA Division I program, let's say, because from what I'm told, that could have been a possibility, but he wanted to stay at Laurier. Even if it was an NCAA Division I program that was not one of the Power Four conferences or down the list, however you want to describe it, I think, honestly, there's a better chance that he's on the roster there. But the Packers have made this decision. We're all going to respect it, but it doesn't mean that we can't question it, because there are people that you'll talk to in the CFL that will just say that, you know, the NFL is similar to the CFL. We harp on some of the personnel mistakes that are made in the CFL. It's just that the NFL is on a bigger scale, so people think that these guys are geniuses, but there's still bad player moves that are made. And I'm not saying that Taylor Eguizma is going to turn out to be a terrible move to release the kid, but it seemed like every step along the way, he was getting better. He was doing what you asked of him, and then he's gone. So what about that time investment that you put into the kid? Like, I'd like to ask Matt LaFleur directly some questions, but I mean, they obviously had some bigger things going on with the trade being talked about behind the scenes with Micah Parsons. So I get that we're talking about a potential third or fourth string quarterback, and the main reason why is because he's a Canadian. But I just can't quite understand some of the NFL's decisions at times. As for his future, as we exclusively reported at 3downnation.com, he had a workout for the New York Giants on Thursday that by all accounts went well, even though, you know, you go to some of these workouts, or these players go to some of these workouts, like this one, for example. Players get woken up at 6 a.m., get asked to do a bunch of football stuff with no breakfast or fuel in them at all. And it's like, hey, go be at your best for us when you're never going to play or practice at that time ever with the Giants or another team. But still, by all accounts, did well. It seems like there is some interest there from the Giants. But you look at the Giants at quarterback, right? They have Russell Wilson, Jameis Winston, Jackson Dart, who they just recently drafted high in the 2025 NFL draft. Joe Shane, the general manager there, said he doesn't want to carry a quarterback at this time on the practice roster. There is some other NFL interest. So I think the smart thing for Eguizma and his camp, and this is what they're going to do, is wait to see, are there any early season injuries? Is there some poor performances? And is there a chance for Eguizma to get in with an NFL team? If not, the next most logical decision is to come up to Winnipeg for a little bit, burn the year off your rookie deal, and then you can still work out for NFL teams in the window. Now, if Eguizma decides to do that, that would preclude him from signing with an NFL team through the 2025 NFL season. And if it goes, you know, into 2026, because I think the last week of the regular season actually does. So there's a decision to be made there, but there's definitely still interest in him. The tape that he put together was really good. Like, the kid was cutting it in there, man. It is clear he has an NFL arm. That was the other thing that didn't make sense to me. Like, he throws a touchdown pass in the preseason against the Colts that gets called back, and Matt LaFleur is like, oh, we absolutely can't make that throw. If Jordan Love made that throw in a game, he would probably be saying, what a great throw. Like, I just don't get it with this NFL politics BS. I'll try to restrain myself, though.
I'm not surprised it worked out this way at all because of what I said weeks ago. Like, Taylor Eguizma is going to have to be the sun, the moon, the stars better than everybody else to get a shot. And he was very good for someone who had never played in front of anywhere close to 60, 70,000 people before in his life. The largest crowd he played in front of was probably what, 8,000 at homecoming. Like, to go out there and have that success, having never really played four down football.
10,000 plus the Senior Bowl. There would have been more than 10,000.
Oh, Senior Bowl. Okay, true.
There's usually 10,000 at Laurier homecoming. Not at now.
Also, the Vanier probably would have had more than 10. What was the attendance for that?
I don't think this last year it was probably Donovan Vanier for attendance. But regardless, okay, so he's maybe a couple of times played, you know, 10,000, maybe a little more. But the bottom line is he was good. And that is not enough when you have the cards stacked that far against you. And look, the NFL, this is not a league where teams typically dress three quarterbacks now. A lot of teams only really want two quarterbacks in the building. And if they have a third one, they're almost like being deceptive about it, because that third guy never actually plays, right? If the first and the second guy get hurt, they go to they make a trade, or they go onto the street and they find a veteran who, it's like, okay, this guy was too expensive to sign out of camp, but we're going to sign him and he's going to be the new starter. Like, NFL teams, I think by and large, have made the decision that once their starter gets hurt, and you know, in some cases it's just one guy, but certainly if the second stringer gets hurt, they're screwed anyway. So like, why would we invest a bunch of money or a bunch of time trying to bring along a third stringer? Like, yes, some teams do it. I'm not saying it never happens, but the culture of the NFL, especially in the last few years when they've been able to just have a couple of quarterbacks dressed per game, seems to be, yeah, we don't really care to have that third developmental guy. We don't really care to have that PR guy. And by the way, I'll say this, the CFL is kind of the same these days. How many third stringers in the CFL are guys who are developing? Most of them are just short yardage guys, right? Like Tommy Stevens, great short yardage guy. Is anybody out here pretending that the Riders are grooming him to be their next franchise quarterback? Like, no. Now, Jack Cohn is there. I know there's four quarterbacks in Saskatchewan, but there's lots of CFL teams that only have, so they've got a starter, a backup who might be developing, might be a vet, and they've got a short yardage guy, and that's it. So that is why it is so tough to make it if you don't have the pedigree of a high draft pick where a team's invested, draft capital in you, a signing bonus in you. It was always going to be really tough for Taylor Elgersma to crack even a PR. I don't blame him for a second for not doing it. He had a good preseason, even a very good preseason, but the dice were stacked against you. And when the dice are just not, like, he basically had to roll whatever, like triple sevens, and he rolled a seven, a six, and a two. And yeah, that's pretty darn good, but it's not good enough to get on a practice roster. So this is not the kid's fault. He did a good job, but I'm not surprised that he didn't stick with the Packers. Hopefully he gets another NFL shot because I think he's deserved that. But we've seen lots of cases where guys come up to the CFL, they play great, they never get an NFL shot. Like, I'll use Eugene Lewis as an example. Eugene Lewis has never signed an NFL contract in his life. And he went to Oklahoma. Like, some guys, for whatever reason, they just don't get a shot. And that sucks because they deserve one. And Elgersma got one. He might not even get a second.
The only thing I'll add to this Elgersma conversation is that sometimes when we're talking about Canadian quarterbacks, I think Dunk and myself especially, but Hodge as well to a certain extent, we get accused of bias, that we are in these guys' corners and we're not seeing them objectively. I just want to bring up some numbers to prove that Taylor Elgersma had a good preseason, that he did enough to deserve a shot on a PR at the very least. This is a stat from the 33rd team, which is a analytics company that works with NFL teams. There were four rookie quarterbacks this preseason who had a positive EPA per dropback. That's expected points added per dropback pass. Number one was Jackson Dart, the first rounder from the aforementioned New York Giants, who had a 0.36 EPA. Number two of all rookie quarterbacks was Taylor Elgersma at 0.27. The only two guys who were also positive was Dylan Gabriel and Riley Leonard. You're talking about guys who went to Ole Miss, guys who went to Oregon, guys who went to Notre Dame, and a guy who went to Wilfrid Laurier. You're telling me that's not worth developing? That he didn't show enough to be on the PR? Clayton Tune didn't have a positive EPA per dropback, that's for sure. So this move just doesn't make sense to me. You knew he was a long-term project. That's why you brought him in, right? Because there is stuff to be uncovered. You had not seen the best of him yet. To me, giving up on that project this soon after such positive returns early on makes absolutely no logical sense.
It's a great point to make, JC, and it's not like we're out here waving the pom-poms for every Canadian quarterback. Who was a kid that signed with the Chargers that shocked all of us?
Casey
Bauman.
Yeah, Casey Bauman.
Like, that didn't make any sense to us from talking to scouts in the CFL, the NFL, and all of a sudden he gets a look with the Chargers. So that's an example, not to throw shade at Casey Bauman, but of us not necessarily just cheering for Canadian quarterbacks. Like, we're trying to provide real perspective here and balance that with the fact that there is legitimate interest in the Canadian quarterbacks and Canadian players and former CFLers that do go down to the National Football League. You know, I think there's other instances where this analysis has been legitimate, and it just boils down to, again, the NFL politics. And JC laid it out well there, that some of these other guys have gone to these high profile schools, and it's easier for these coaches or general managers to say, well, this guy didn't work out, but you know, comes from this football factory that's used to producing players. And to take it even further, like the list of quarterbacks that was released, some of them have now signed on practice rosters, but when the initial 53-man rosters were made, included like multiple mid-round picks. So when we're having this conversation, I think it's important to realize too that Taylor Elgersma is not just going against like the latest class to go in the NFL. He's going against obviously the veteran starters. That's a whole other level and not really in that conversation yet. Definitely not in that conversation yet. But he's trying to make the roster against some back end guys that are out on the street that people would recognize. Like a guy like Tyler Snoop Huntley has started games for the Baltimore Ravens. I believe he's re-signed there, I think, to their practice roster. So I don't want to go through the whole list, but it was like a list of like 50 plus quarterbacks of recognizable names. So the EPA stat is great, but it's also you're fighting this uphill political battle. So I think he deserves a shot. That's an unbiased take. It would have been super interesting to see if he went that NCAA route for even just a year, if he could have risen to a status like Curtis Rourke, who's been stashed on injured reserve with the San Francisco 49ers. And it seems that they're high on his potential upside. And JC, you've talked about it on the pod before, but it might bear worth repeating that if you switch the names on the back of those jerseys, it might be hard to tell the difference.
Yeah, I think Taylor has the stronger arm of the two, right? Kurgis has proven it at the so-called higher level, right? And I think he's a great vision of the field, where he gets the ball out quick. He was fantastic in that Indiana offense. He's clearly a winner. But when it comes to just raw physical talent and arm strength, I've seen Taylor up close. You've seen Taylor up close. There's not a lot of quarterbacks at any level that can match his pure arm strength, because I've seen CFL quarterbacks that don't have nearly the amount of zip that he does. I've been down at the College Gridiron Showcase, which of course is not the top level all-star game by any stretch of the imagination, but has quality quarterbacks from big time schools for multiple years now. And I've never seen a guy throw the ball as fast and with as much zip as Taylor did. Like, he is a different cat in that regard. And if he had gone that NCAA route, or he had got the lucky break like Curtis Rourke did, which was that his brother was already at Ohio and was able to bring him into that Bobcats program when he, and the coaches have been frank about this, would not have been recruited there otherwise. If Taylor had gotten that same opportunity coming out of high school, I think we'd be having a different conversation right now about where his NFL prospects are.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Speaking of NFL quarterbacks, JC, it's time for your segment.
You're missing one.
No. What am I doing? Whoa.
Doug is off his game today.
Golly.
We are recording this pretty late Eastern time, so I think you're just a little overslept.
It's bedtime for Doug.
Old man Doug. Bedtime Doug.
Circadian rhythm, man. That's what we're calling it. Hodge, there were two wild finishes in U Sports football, otherwise known as Canadian University three down ball this week. Why don't you tell everybody about them?
Well, two unbelievable finishes, and I highlighted both of them on my Twitter feed if you want to see any of the highlights. We'll start in Calgary, where the Dinos got knocked off by the number 10 nationally ranked Regina Rams, reigning Hardy Cup champion Regina Rams. And the reason this one is wild, like, I was flipping between this and the Alberta-Saskatchewan game. Huskies won that one. And I actually turned this one off with about a minute left, which is a cardinal sin you should never do in Canadian football. But the reason I did it is because the Rams went up 9 points. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm no mathematician, but 9 points is not a lead you can really overcome in the last minute of a game. I will flip to the other game. Well, lo and behold, the Dinos score a touchdown. They get the 2-point convert with 6 seconds left. So 6 seconds, not really enough time to hit the onside and then go for it. So what do they do instead? Well, all of a sudden, Vince Trimbari, who I hope I'm saying his name right, boots an 85-yard rouge off the kickoff to send the game to overtime. That's how you score 9 points into possession. It's touchdown, 2-point convert, rouge on the kickoff. Now, I do think the Rams erred a little bit here, only having one guy back in the end zone. But if you watch the highlight of it, Trimbari, unbelievable kick. Like, that ball traveled at least 70 yards in the air. Unbelievable, tremendous finish. Then the Rams did win. The other one is Waterloo, Toronto. This game was wild. Toronto gets the score here. Jake Austin, 53-yard touchdown from Scott Barnett with 9 seconds left to give the Varsity Blues the lead. Well, guess what happens? 9 seconds on the clock. Toronto, huge mistake on the ensuing kickoff. It goes out of bounds, so therefore Waterloo gets the scrimmage at the 40. One play, 8 seconds, 20-yard pass, 1 second left on the clock. They send out the kicker, which is nuts. 57-yarder, Evan Astolfo, money. Makes the kick, ties it up, sends it to overtime, and then Astolfo kicks a 21-yard game winner in overtime. Like, two unbelievable finishes, two Canadian finishes. We got multiple scores in the last literally 6 or 9 seconds of games. We got rouges. We got craziness. Like, unbelievable. Full credit to all these teams. It was absolutely sensational stuff. And I'm just glad that I got to witness it. I just wish these games were on national television. That's all I'm saying.
I wish they were too. Unfortunately, I didn't get to tune into these games because I was in the middle of nowhere with no cell reception at a wedding. But I did get a chance to go to the Manitoba UBC opener on Thursday. And that was not nearly as good of a game. But I will give credit to UBC as a whole. A crowd for a home opener like this, in my time going to UBC games, I don't know that I've seen. It was at least 6,000 people there. They had the Jumpstart students out. Those are international students typically, or students from further away who come out a week early to get acclimatized to university before the rest of students report. They gave them all free tickets to the game, loaded them into the stadium, which was a long process. It was still going on well into the first quarter, but it created a great atmosphere, one that you typically don't get at T-Birds games unless it's a homecoming. And UBC capitalized on it. Manitoba made some mistakes, but the Thunderbirds were able to get the win 21-9 over Manitoba, an upset based on the fact that the Bisons were ranked number 8 going into the season. And for the cost of the ticket, which was like $15, to get that atmosphere and to see players of that level, we've talked about it before, you aren't going to find a better product for cheaper in this country. If you're near a U Sports campus and there's a football game going on, you should check it out.
You know, I asked Stuart Johnston about this idea, and it kind of came to me partly because Trevor Harris was talking about rivalries. And he actually mentioned the Regina Rams and Saskatchewan Huskies, which was impressive. I like that he added it in there. So when I was thinking about it and asked Stuart Johnson, I said, like, why couldn't we create a whole Labor Day weekend that's intertwined with U Sports? You know, we talk a lot of time about the Vanier Cup and the Grey Cup, which I think is a shoo-in. Like, that just needs to happen. The powers that be need to figure that out. But for Labor Day, in the weekend, you know, usually there's not any games in the CFL on the Saturday or the Friday night. So if you had those rivalries going on traditionally in the calendar, and I think like Regina should always play Saskatchewan twice in the season. Like that should just always be the case. So I think on one of those nights, particularly, you know, it stuck out to me because I was in Regina for the Labor Day Classic between the Bombers and Riders. I was thinking if there was a game on Saturday night or even the Saturday afternoon, there's a lot of people in town. Like from reading some of the local news there, it seemed like all the hotels were sold out. I know definitely Hotel Saskatchewan was sold out for that weekend. Like you have people there looking for an event. I'm not saying there's not other events around the game, but like some of this stuff is just like right in front of us. If you had a Rams Huskies game at Mosaic Stadium on Saturday afternoon or Saturday night leading into the Labor Day Classic, I know there's a turnaround and you got to get the stadium cleaned up. But are you telling me in like 24 hours, you wouldn't be able to clean up the stadium and get some new refreshments and food in there and the stuff you need for the concessions? Like that would be great. I think you could do the same thing out in Calgary on the Sunday. Perhaps you have the Golden Bears come down the road and play the Dinos at McMahon Stadium. Again, I know you have to have the turnaround, but like, let's start putting some of these ideas out there. And to his credit, Stuart Johnston liked that idea. I mean, you'd have to look about how you would go about it in the OUA, but I think like McMaster versus the University of Toronto, there's not a big rivalry there, but if you're going to build off the Toronto-Hamilton rivalry, that would be one that could make sense to me. You already have a bunch of people that are jazzed up about football on that weekend, possibly looking for a game to go to the day before the big CFL version. Like to me, this is some easy stuff and it helps the CFL because then you're help building those stars for the future. So let's see if it can happen.
Two quick corrections for me from last week. One, the U Sports stats, which were miserable in week one, were a little better in week two, still shaky. They are not provided by Genius Sports. The plan, what I was told, was to transition to Genius Sports this year. Unfortunately, according to my sources, it was too expensive for U Sports, and the CFL wasn't willing to give them a free license of sorts. So they are now with servants called Presto, which apparently will work at some point, but right now they're working on a bunch of bugs. They used to be with Stats Crew. The issue with Stats Crew is it requires DOS to run. That's how old it is. And if you don't know what DOS is, congratulations on being under the age of 30. If you do know what DOS is, I hope you're enjoying your back.
JC has his hand up.
I have no idea what DOS is.
The other thing that I got wrong is I said Clarence Hicks of the Calgary Stampeders was coming off an Achilles tear. I was incorrect. I misremembered. It's Charles Wiley who is coming off the Achilles. If you don't know who Charles Wiley is, he's the one who took a phantom roughing the kicker call in Labor Day and then lost his ever-loving mind. He's helmet on the ground and screaming. So he had the ACL or the Achilles, not Clarence Hicks. So my apologies for erring. JC, it is now time for your random neglister.
Okay, we're going with the Calgary Stampeders this week. And I was looking at some of the NFL cuts, and I found out that there was only four draft picks from this last 2025 class that weren't either on an NFL 53-man roster, injured list, or practice roster right now. And one of the names stuck out like a sore thumb. It is quarterback slash wide receiver Tommy Mellott from Montana State. He was a sixth-round pick of the Las Vegas Raiders. Seems like the organization wasn't in alignment. Their GM wanted to keep him around and develop him. Pete Carroll wanted to bring in people that could help him win now. That could eventually be the Calgary Stampeders' benefit because this is a guy who is an absolute unicorn. The Walter Payton winner last year as the top player in FCS football. He runs a 4.39 40-yard dash as a quarterback, 41-inch vert. This guy can move over the course of his career, over 6,000 passing yards, 55 touchdowns, just 8 interceptions, and then on top of that, over 3,500 rushing yards and 43 touchdowns on the ground. He is a dynamic playmaker. Some people have questioned his arm strength, whether he can be the guy at QB in the big moments. but he's athletic enough that if you bring him in, if you don't want him to be the QB, do what the Raiders did and try him out as a wide receiver. You're not going to have very many players in the CFL who run legit 4.3s like he does. He can return kicks. He can catch passes. He can throw and be a gimmick guy. He can run short yardage, even though he's under 6 foot and only 200 pounds. He's that level of toughness. This is your do-it-all gadget guy who you can stick anywhere on the field, and he's just going to be a dynamic, game-breaking presence. I would love to see Tommy Mellott on a CFL field.
Why couldn't he have the upside to be a franchise quarterback here in the NFL? This is kind of what I don't get, right? Like, look at these metrics. He's proven he can pass the football and take care of it too. Yet the Raiders don't want to keep the guy, and the Packers think Clayton Tune is better than this kid.
To me, I would let him be a quarterback first, and if he fails at that, turn him into something else, because there are questions about the arm strength. I get that. But to me, when you are that dynamic as a weapon, and we've had the same conversation with Trey Ford, who I think is the only comparable as an athlete that I can think of for being that fast, besides maybe a Lamar Jackson, you create an offense where you can utilize that, and then the arm strength is a bonus, or anything else on top of that as a passer is a bonus. There is a way to have an offense built around Tommy Mellott, in my opinion. And it's notable that the Stampeders do list him as a QB on their neg list. Whether that's where they actually see him, we don't know, but that is the position he's given on their list.
And former Walter Payton Award winner, Dave Dickinson, is the head coach and GM.
That's true.
It's now time for Hodges Heritage Moment. On this day in 2008, by the way, my teenage heart broke this day, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers traded Charles Roberts to the BC Lions in exchange for Joe Smith. The native of Montclair, California, was named a CFL All-Star in each of his first 7 seasons with Winnipeg and earned the nickname Blink due to his elite agility. Roberts was an enigmatic character who challenged authority and smoked cigarettes. That's right. In 2008, I was in high school. Charles Roberts was a professional athlete, but he was the one smoking darts, which led to Winnipeg trading him away when he was just 13 rushing yards shy of 10,000 on his career. He retired following the 2008 season with 1,918 career carries for 10,285 yards, 268 catches for 3,396 yards, and 84 total touchdowns. He was inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame in 2014. Dunk, can you imagine trading a player away, a franchise legend, 13 yards away from 10,000 on their career?
I think there's more to the story there from what I'm told. Doug Barry didn't want anything to do with his off-field antics, let's call them. And Arash Madani shared a little more of a deeper story into Charles Roberts. And it revolves around the Labor Day Classic. Okay, he talked about it on the Sports Cage. He said that his pre-game meal, if you will, was hacking some darts, 2 Snickers bars, 2 Red Bulls, from a 7-Eleven on the way to the stadium. And I think he drove himself there as part of the story too. And that was just before he got traded. And I think he had somehow, miraculously, a great game in that Labor Day Classic. From hacking darts, couple Snickers bars, some Red Bulls, and a quick stop at 7-Eleven on the way to the stadium. Unbelievable.
Whatever works for you, eh?
Hey, that sounds more or less like how I got through the 2023 Grey Cup. So I'm just saying. It's now time for the 3-minute drill.
Hey, the Canadian Junior Football League's Hamilton Hurricanes hosted the first ever Ted Gavaya Bowl to honor the Tiger Cats GM who is battling cancer. Is that a nice idea?
Absolutely. Ted Gavaya spent years at the CJFL level coaching the Burlington Braves. This is a great way to honor him. And the Hurricanes won this game 50-0. So there you go. Good team to start the year. The Argonauts defensive lineman, Andrew Chatfield, was fined for 2 hits on Canadian quarterback Nathan Rourke. Were those fines warranted?
Absolutely. You can't hit QBs high. You can't hit QBs late. He did both. He didn't seem to have any respect for the timing of the passing plays on that particular day. I think the fines were warranted. They weren't egregious to the level of a max fine, but they definitely were worthy of some punishment. Ajoa Ajoa returned to the Saskatchewan Roughriders following his NFL stint and made an immediate impact in the Labor Day Classic, catching two passes for 8 yards, including a late-game two-point conversion. How impactful could he be for the team down the stretch?
I think there's definitely some upside there with Ajoa Ajoa. It's a familiar offense for him. Like, he started the game on the first snap on offense for Saskatchewan. The odd man out, it seems, is going to be Mitch Pickton from an active game day roster standpoint. And then it appeared that he was rotating with Del Duncan Busby, because I think the Riders really love Tommy Neal. So Ajoa down the stretch, as he gets back into the CFL game, I think has a chance to make a real impact, fellas. But we've rarely seen players come back from the NFL and have great ends of the season. We'll see if Ajoa can buck that trend. Adam Big Hill made his Calgary Stampeders debut on Monday, recording 4 tackles in the Stamps' Labor Day win. Can he be impactful for Calgary down the stretch?
I think so. I mean, Mike Kitsaitz has been good in that defense, so I think it's good to kind of rotate Biggie in there. But, I mean, we all know Biggie's going to the Hall of Fame, so he can only make that defense better. It's already a great defense, but I think he can make it better. The Cleveland Browns have cut former Argonauts defensive lineman Ralph Hawley after he initially made their practice roster. Could he be back in the CFL soon?
I'm sure he's going to exhaust all NFL opportunities after already making a practice roster. You would think there would be some other interest, but if it doesn't arise, with the Argonauts making a push here and potentially getting themselves back into playoff contention, that would be a really nice add for them down the stretch as they're going into the postseason to get an interior pass rush presence like Hawley. A group of fans walked all the way from BMO Field to Hamilton Stadium to raise money for CFL Fans Fight Cancer. Have you ever done that walk?
I have not, but I feel like I could do it. And I think actually, I don't know about you, JC, John Hodge would be able to make it with me. He did some long walks when he was in Toronto and made it sound like no big deal.
It depends on the pace.
You just
got to
wear ergonomic shoes. It's about the ergonomic shoes. If you don't care about looking like a dork, you can walk all day, it turns out. I learned that at the age of 30, and I'm keeping that. I don't care about other people got these nice fancy. I don't care. I'm wearing my New Balance, and at the end of the day, my feet aren't going to hurt.
New Balance are cool, bro. I got nothing against New
no,
Balance.
No, not the ones I wear. I don't care.
you got the all-white Uncle at the Barbecue shoes?
I got that is what I wear, my friend, and I make no apologies for it. You're damn straight. At the end of the night, my feet are not going to hurt. That's all I care about. Done.
Good old Unky Hodge. Ontario Pokey Wilson has signed with the Blue Bombers following his training camp stint with the New York Jets. Could he make a big impact with the team?
I think he could. And ironically, like, as much as the Bombers made a ton of mistakes in that Labor Day game, I thought it was the best game for their receiving core. Like, Kevin Clarcius, ridiculous catch. Dylan Mitchell, his best game as a Bomber. Shown a go-to guy. Nick Dembski, obviously a go-to guy. So suddenly the Bombers, a position of weakness, seems to be becoming a position of strength. The Edmonton Elks have signed first-round global draft pick Richard Jaboner. How significant is that signing?
I think it's a fairly significant signing, guys. This was my top overall player in this year's global draft.
Who? How do you say it?
Jaboner?
Hodge just said Jaboner.
I think it's Jaboner. He's from Nigeria, and he was a hell of a college player. Former 4-star recruit to Auburn, transferred to Troy. He's fourth all-time for Troy in career sacks with over 40. This guy can bend the edge. I think the only reason he fell to third overall and is only signing now, as I understand it, is there was some visa issues in terms of allowing him to sign with the team. But now that that's sorted out, and with Cody Grace on the injured list, there's an opening for a second global in there on that Edmonton roster. I think he could contribute for them. Unfortunately, we have to end the podcast today on a somber note, as shortly after we recorded last week, longtime CFL scout and personnel executive Craig Smith lost his long battle with cancer at the age of 69. We've talked about Craig Smith on the podcast before. This is a guy that nobody in the league has a bad word to say about. Loved football more than anyone. And for me, I only got the chance to meet Craig once in person at last year's combine in Regina, which was a a special moment for me, and I got the chance to talk to him about the fact that I'm only sitting where I am today, guys, because of Craig Smith. Because when I was a student at the University of British Columbia and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life and how to get back involved with football, which I was missing so much, I read an article about Craig Smith and how he went from coaching Pee-wee at the Westside Warriors while he was at UBC to making it all the way to the CFL as a scout. And I said to myself, that's what I want to do. And so I signed up to coach Pee-wee with the Westside Warriors. He inspired me to get involved in my local community. I'm a coach to this day. Obviously, we took different paths in our routes to being around the CFL. But that was the impact that Craig Smith had on people who didn't even know him well because of what he was able to do and how much respect people had for him around this league. He will be truly missed.
He definitely will. His wife, Kathy, was always with him. I had so many interactions with him over the years. He loved all football, but specifically, you know, Canadian football. He'd be scouting NFL camps and have the U Sports games on or the Canadian Junior Football League games on, and he tracked the Canadians, you know, so well. Obviously, it was his job, but he respected them just as well as anybody else that he scouted. And, you know, from a personal standpoint, he was a scout at the time. I believe it was for the BC Lions, and then he changed to Saskatchewan. But he actually came to the University of Guelph when he was a scout with the BC Lions and worked me out as a receiver. And what I respected the most, that I can't remembering getting feedback from any other scout, was the fact that he actually told me what I needed to work on to get to that level. Now, I feel like so much of our time spent as an athlete trying to get to that level is figuring it out. But he actually helped me understand what it was that I needed to work at and took the time after the workout, you know, timing me in the 40 and doing all those different types of things to say, hey, this is what you got to do. And I really respected it. And then little did I know how impactful he would be in my professional career in another capacity, not in the Canadian Football League as a player, but covering it. He helped me understand the game and just how vital they were to the league. I had an idea, but I was so focused on my football career and that was like all my world at that point, that after I graduated, which is like a death of me, and I'm sure other student athletes would say that when you don't make it to the pros, that you're trying to find yourself. And he helped me find that passion, similar to you, JC, for covering the CFL draft. That's really how I got started with this. You know, he explained like how he went about it. He wasn't giving away trade secrets or anything, but he would steer me towards the players that I should focus my coverage on, with all due respect, not the guys that, you know, weren't going to have a shot at the pros. So helped lend his scouting eye to me. So, I mean, it was a tough day to learn of his passing. And, you know, I cherish some of those memories. Like I saw him at Libel Field last year for the final, I believe it was Canada West game of the regular season, when the Rams won to somehow make the playoffs in a crazy scenario. But the fact that he just was even putting in the effort to help, or not to help get there, his wife Kathy actually helped get him there, but just, you know, to get there and see people, he was so classy. Like in a world of pro football where it's so cutthroat, he was such a classy guy, and he showed that it's possible to be classy even when you're in professional football. I'm not saying that there's nobody out there that isn't classy, but he just did it in such a respectful way. He legitimately would ask you, you know, how's your family doing? How are you doing? And he cared about the answer. It wasn't that cliche question that we ask so many times in society now where it's like, hey, how's it going? Where it's like people are expecting a one-word answer. Like he legitimately wanted to hear, right? We would talk about the Guelph Griffins and Canadian University football and his beloved, I don't know why he liked the team, but the New York Yankees that he liked to keep up with. Craig Smith was a true good one in Canadian professional football and intertwined in Canadian University football. We're better for having him in our lives, but it's a sad day when he passed away.
Absolutely. Much love to Craig's family and friends. I think you guys have covered it. Very well said. And we thank you, as always, for listening to the Three Down Nation podcast. For Justin Dunk and JC Abbott, I'm John Hodge. Check back to this podcast feed, this YouTube channel, on Thursday for my picks with JC. For week 14 in the CFL, we got Super Saturday, boys. Three games back to back to back. If you can make it to the last one, you win a prize. And the prize is a massage, because you're going to need it after sitting on that butt for 9 straight hours. My goodness, you're going to be sore.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.